Okay, thank you. So I'll change gear somewhat here because I'm going to really talk about some of the problems we have in seismic inversion rather than present all the solutions, because we don't have all the solutions today. So just acknowledge my colleagues in Schlumberger, Cambridge and Schlumberger, Gatwick. For those that don't know, Schlumberger, Cambridge is like 15 minutes walk west of here. It's between the University Science here and the M11. So we are local. So introduction to what we're trying to do. So marine seismic survey, we have a boat, basically goes along and it tows a bunch of cable. Oops, I shouldn't have pressed that one. Okay, so the boat essentially tows a bunch of cables behind it. And you can see the kind of scale here. Here's a little boat, and here you can see some of the turbulence from floats which hold the cables up. Just to give an idea of the scale of this, here's a picture of Oslo. And superimposed on that is a seismic vessel, and basically you can see the red lines and the yellow lines basically are the streamers. So this is several kilometres long. And each of these cables has many sources and receivers on it. So basically they're sending out acoustic sources and measuring the signal with hydrophones. So a 3D survey is actually quite a large volume. So this might be, say, 10 kilometres long, might be a kilometre or so wide. And the sea is several kilometres deep, or certainly the area we're trying to image is several kilometres deep. So that gives you an idea of the volume of data and why 3D is a big challenge for us. So just to illustrate that in more detail, what we're seeing here, here's the seismic boat, and there's actually several cables. In practice, there are different cables, because then one could try and separate out upgoing and downgoing signals to get an idea of reflected waves off the surface, because we really want to remove those in the processing. Because really what we want to see is the subsurface. You don't really want to see the surface of the sea. We don't want to invert from the sea surface, so we have to remove those. Just mention briefly, without talking the figures, what kind of frequency range we're looking at. So typically we're looking at, say, between 3 hertz and a few hundred hertz. So it's not massively high frequency we're going to look at today. It's actually a challenge to get low frequency data. If we can get low frequency data, we'd be delighted. Low frequency data suffers from a lot of noise. So typical seismic wavelength we're looking at is tens of meters in this context. Again, I won't describe this. This is by way of introduction of illustrating our problem. So here's our seismic boat again, and it's towing all these sources and receivers behind it. And it's quite a challenge to keep them in position. What we actually need to know is the position, the relative positions of the sources and receivers in these arrays. So it's actually quite a challenge to keep them in place. And what actually happens, there's a bunch of little devices with wings on, and basically they go up and down and try and control the height and lateral position. If we don't actually know where these sources and receivers are, then it's pretty pointless trying to image the Earth's interior, because we don't know where we started from. So one more slide of introduction and I'll talk about some mathematics. So what happens then, let's look at the picture here. So typically we might have a seismic source here. So at the top we've got water shown in white. Here's essentially the subsurface. This is rock, basically, and here's a reflector. So typically we have a bunch of waves in ray theory, go down, reflect off, come back up again, or they might just go round, turn, the turning point, and come back up again. And then we'll record all of these rays. Often the data is pretty noisy, and what people end up with is something they call a seismic image, and they're very hard to interpret. That's some kind of measure of what's actually below the surface. The actual seismic data turns out of these messy signals. So here's time going down this axis. This is like a receiver going along here, corresponding to this axis. And what people then try and do is try and make sense of these signals. So just to mention, you can see several events in these signals, and you kind of see a very strong event here. So it's a question of what's actually measured. And some people just try and measure early seismic inversion algorithms just used to measure travel time. So they just look at the slope going down here. So what we try and do now is use the full wave field, which of course is more expensive. Now the Earth is usually pretty complex, because the Earth we're trying to image is inhomogeneous, anisotropic and anelastic. And the reason we're trying to do this is we're trying to find oil, essentially. So we're trying to image the stratigraphy and then to find oil and gas. Now, of course, we don't like anisotropic and elastic inhomogeneous materials, so we pretend everything's acoustic to start with. So we're going to assume isotropic, inhomogeneous, and acoustic. So our subsurface velocity model we're trying to image would be something of this nature. So here's a velocity model, and this is a typical North Sea slump fault structure. Acoustic approximation is usually pretty good at short offsets. So our acoustic problem, basically, I'll describe this in 2D and I'll show you some results of computations in 2D. So we take our favourite Helmholtz equation with a variable sound speed C. C is a function of X, where X is a subset of R3. So a Born approximation for a scattering would give this equation. So there are two Green's functions in it, and this is a scattering kernel. Now, it depends on the frequency. As I said, our frequency is not going to be very high. We're going to take typically less than 100 hertz. That involved two Green's functions. Now, typically, how can we approximate the Green's functions? So we have a modelling operator. So how are we going to forward model the Helmholtz equation? So we can use the full wave equation. We can use perhaps a one-way approximation to the wave equation. We might want to use asymptotic approximation to the wave equation. We might want to use a Maslow approximation, Gaussian beam approximation, coherent state approximation, etc. And I'll discuss different modelling assumptions a bit later. So I'd like to talk about one approach that I've been involved in for inverting the seismic velocity from surface measurements. And it's based on PDE constrained optimization. So we're trying to solve least squares problems for the seismic velocity. So this is going to be based on the full wave equation, and then I'll move on to approximations which don't use a full wave equation later. We're going to do it in a frequency domain. So by doing the frequency domain, I don't really need to describe what these equations are. So the acoustic wave equation written in terms of pressure or velocities, we might want to use either depending on what we're actually measuring. So we're stuck with the Helmholtz equation because we've used the acoustic equation. Helmholtz equation, as we know, is very difficult to solve, and I'll mention briefly attempts to solve it using a multigrid solver. We'll look at a multiscale approach for inversion, and then we'll look at what happens if we try and use geometrical optics theory and extensions to geometrical optics by using rays and an asymptotic approach. And then what we're also interested in is we're not interested in an inversion, we're interested in a range of inversions. So we need to know uncertainty, because uncertainty tells us, is there oil there or not? So a least squares frequency domain formulation. I need to really read the equation, but it's a least squares objective function, difference between observed and calculated. So as a function of frequency. Observed, and here's a calculated. M is the model parameter. So this is going to be velocity, density, whatever in these circumstances. So a PDE constrained optimization approach, one would differentiate that. And what we actually use is an adjoint approach to calculate the fresh air derivatives, which is, I guess, common in PDE constrained optimization. So we're going to use a gradient-based inversion approach for this. So our forward model rather conveniently dropped the Helmholtz equation, and we just call it A times U is equal to F, so that's our linear equation, Helmholtz equation. It's got to be discretized. So differentiate each term separately gives us the Jacobian, which is du with respect to M. So of course we can't calculate that because that's a rather nasty beast. But if one used the standard adjoint approximation, then we actually get a simple expression for the derivative. So let's just illustrate those. So the thing to mention here is this equation here depends on a forward solution of the wave equation. That's our forward Green's function. This one is our backward Green's function. So it's forward propagation and back propagation. I just mentioned that because the seismic literature always talks about forward and back propagation, and all it is an adjoint expression. So the multiscale approach, actually, it's not something we've invented. Various people have looked at this, most recent being Pratt, Queen's University in Canada, doing it in the frequency domain. The advantage of doing the frequency domain is that it can be very efficient on small data sets, and we really have a challenge with doing this in 3D. We don't really want to solve it in the time domain because it's too expensive. So the idea of doing this is that one inverts at low frequencies, say 3 hertz, and that's our starting velocity model for a 5 hertz inversion, and then for 7 hertz inversion, and so on. And the idea is that, of course, for low frequencies, large wavelengths, large basin of attraction, so you don't fall into multiple minima. So that's the approach. And various people do this. They're Pratt, Gattas, Tromp in earthquake seismology. So we take a test model. This is a two-dimensional test model. And we can see it's quite a complicated velocity profile. So velocity doesn't increase monotonically with depth in this case, and it's pretty complex. There's some occluded regions. And we're going to try it and recover that velocity profile from surface measurements. So surface measurements for solving the Helmholtz equation. So first approximation, one needs to use travel time tomography. So this kind of gets the zero order asymptotics correct. If we don't use surface, if we don't have correct travel times, we haven't got a hope of inverting this. We need to get within the basin of attraction. So we can fairly easy to calculate to use surface tomography. And then one can calculate the sensitivities for different frequencies, different source receiver configurations. So if we look at that, so I've only run up to 20 hertz here, just for illustration. So the bottom figure is actually the exact velocity model. So you can see in here some sort of very high velocity channels and some faulted structure. And by going to 16 hertz inversion, we got a pretty good result. It does depend on the number of sources and receivers. You need a lot of sources and receivers basically all along the top surface. And the idea is that then the waves, they go down to the subsurface. They're either scattered, they're reflected, or they actually turn. The important one is actually the turning rays, not the scattered rays. The diffracted rays are very important here. So we can get a reasonable solution using this method. So let's move on. We just want to look at, again, taking our velocity model and actually draw a vertical line right through it in the Z direction. And we see how well do we do in inverting this velocity model. Okay, so the difficult part is a very sharp feature in the velocity model. Remember I showed you there was an occluded region. We've got a very high velocity and a low velocity behind it. So that's extremely difficult to image seismically. So that corresponds to this feature here. And well, we can't actually image that feature very well. And the reason is basically we're using two low frequency waves. So we have to use very high frequency waves to image that. And of course, if we use high frequency waves, we have a bigger problem, which is why we're talking about high frequency oscillations here. So otherwise, we did pretty well for the low frequencies, and we did manage to recover a pretty good velocity profile here. So the optimization, I said I was using a gradient method, so then the optimizer, I guess, is fairly standard, so there's nothing special we're doing here, it's just a standard PDE-constrained optimization. With the proviso, of course, we can't calculate Hessian, so as we heard earlier, we love matrix vector products, and that's all we're going to do. It's a matrix vector product, we're happy. We want to invert for velocity, maybe density, maybe we don't even know the source. There's a lot of uncertainty about what the sources are. Well, we know where the source is, but we don't actually know the source signature, so we don't actually know the wavelet. We have constraints, there are physical constraints on velocity, we just use gradient projection method for that. For regularization, essentially we're going to use a total variation regularization. So this is fairly common, I guess, in optics, and Gattas et al. All use total variation regularization. Essentially L2 or H2, Tikhonov, is pretty useless in these cases. So then our objective is a least squares objective plus some function of frequency times total variation, which is the L1 norm of the first derivative. And so we use a standard Gauss-Newton line search. And again, we can't calculate Hessian, so any approximation to the Hessian is good for us. So the real problem is that the modeling cost, because we're solving a Helmholtz equation, in forward and inverse mode, multiple times with many right-hand sides, it's a computationally intensive problem. Because we're solving the Helmholtz equation many times, I didn't mention the discretization, so it's actually quite embarrassing. A lot of this, we're just using finite differences for the Helmholtz equation. And in the seismic industry, we do use finite differences a lot. We could use spectral elements or finite elements, but finite differences, for the purpose of illustration, it's still a large problem, and we still have to invert that matrix. So multiple right-hand side linear solver is what we need. That's fine if we can fit a direct parallel direct solver or even a serial direct solver into our memory. But what about multi-grid solution of the Helmholtz equation? So fortunately, there was some work done at Delft University a year or so ago, and they came up with a very clever idea to precondition the Helmholtz operator. So the problem with the Helmholtz, as we know, it's non-coercive, it's non-local, you see action at a distance. We're modeling an anelastic equation, there's no attenuation, it's very difficult to solve. So what these guys did, they said, let's introduce a different approximation to the Helmholtz equation for preconditioners. It's actually a shifted, they call it a shifted Laplace preconditioner. And simply the idea is it's a complex wave number. If one's careful about choosing these parameters, the complex wave number term, it actually gives a reasonable approximation to a preconditioner. So this is what we tried, and then one can use standard multigrid with a GMRes outer loop. So this is a fairly challenging problem. This is a subsort velocity structure here. So the salt is more or less a constant velocity. It's more or less a homogeneous inclusion, but it's a very high velocity relative to the background. So this velocity in the salt might be 5 kilometers a second. The background velocity might be, say, 2 or 3 kilometers a second. So there's quite a contrast. And then one computed a wave field, you can see all sorts of diffractions around the salt boundary here. So the idea is by using this multigrid algorithm, one can actually reduce the cost significantly. So this is, a standard GMRes or something. Iteration very slow. Multigrid is actually several orders of magnitude faster. Well, that's per iteration count. I haven't actually showed the CPU, so we're still working on how to reduce the CPU significantly. There's still some. It's open research basically doing this. We can demonstrate convergence more or less independent of the number of grids as one would like in a multigrid algorithm, but we still have problems when the grid gets too coarse. Actually, the convergence gets worse. So this is kind of an open. There's a lot of open numerical problems here, which we're trying to work on with Delft University. So, alternative approach, we have this problem with solving the Helmholtz equation in 3D. Alternative approach is let's avoid the Helmholtz equation. So let's actually avoid solving the Helmholtz equation. We actually use ray theory. So I mentioned before, we believe at low frequencies that we're really interested in refracted energy, not reflected energy. Reflected energy is a high frequency phenomenon. So if we just concentrate on refracted energy, we think we can get pretty good results, which actually is borne out by finite difference modeling with low frequencies. Now, asymptotic ray theory breaks down. As we know, we get caustics. The amplitudes are not correct. So various extensions have been proposed over, 40 years or so by mathematicians and seismologists to deal with the breakdown of asymptotic ray theory. So in this case, we have a source, we have a receiver, and I've shown a bunch of rays, and then we have a bunch of plane waves. And the idea is to create a synthesis by integrating over plane rays to add up the term at the receiver. So rather than using the direct arrival at the receiver, actually one uses all the neighboring arrivals as well. So that's what Maslow did, 30 years ago, and was introduced to seismology by Chris Chapman about 20 years ago. Now, unfortunately, when we looked at some fairly simple models, the rays actually get pretty complex. So what we actually see is that this is a fairly simple model. What we actually see is we see a bunch of guided wave energy, and we see some pseudo caustics, and we see some caustics. So things still break down. So even with these extensions to ray theory, you get pseudo caustics, and that breaks down. So whatever you do, you get something else that breaks down in more or less any realistic model. So it's still quite a challenge. And again, what we've shown here is a velocity model. And what you see here is a finite difference solution. You can see the amplitudes by the bright peaks, and you can see the rays. Again, you can see the guided energy. So that's what's actually happening below the subsurface. So, and then it's a question, what we're trying to do is image this from whichever ray is actually bent up. Of course, this is only a limited angle of illumination here. So in the seismic record, what one then sees is time going down this axis. This is horizontal along here. So this is this axis. One actually sees a strong signal here corresponding to first arrival, but there's a lot of energy behind it. So what we actually need to do is use all these signals. So because we're looking at the frequency domain, we Fourier transformed along this direction, get a single number, and that's what we're using in our inversion. So if we did it in the time domain, it would be a much more complicated objective function. We could do it. People that just invert for first arrivals, well, they've only got this information, so they don't see any of this. So the idea of Maslow won't read out that equation. Basically, it's an integral over plane waves, and these funny factors looking like Hilbert transform arise from a stationary phase argument. But what we're really interested in, if we use this approach, because it's no longer a PDE, we can't use PDE constrained optimization, and I wanted to use a gradient approach to invert for low frequencies, so I have to calculate the sensitivities of all these. So I need to calculate the derivatives of all these approximations with respect to M. M is my subsurface velocity model, which is, say, acoustic velocity. Let's just make a few approximations. So typically, if we take a zeroth order asymptotic ray approximation, would be function of omega. Well, if it's in 3D, it's easier. We can get rid of that. So an amplitude times a e to the I omega t. T is a travel time solution to an Eiffel equation. So if we differentiate that with respect to the model, we're going to get two terms. One which involves the derivative of the amplitude with respect to the model. Now, what people usually do in seismology is get rid of it because it's a weaker dependence, and what we're really interested in is the phase errors, the derivative of travel time with respect to the model. So if we use that approximation, then we can differentiate a Maslow waveform with respect to a model approximately, but we still have to basically calculate all these derivatives. So we can go ahead and calculate these derivatives. It's a Hamiltonian system. So asymptotic ray theory is based on a Hamiltonian system. So writing it down for an acoustic approximation, it doesn't look too difficult. So dynamic ray tracing is about solving a set of ordinary differential equations along a ray trajectory, which gives us essentially the position, slowness, then that we can then derive from that amplitude quantities. So we can actually do the same by extending this. We can actually calculate our Fréchet derivatives of the solution with respect to velocity, subsurface velocity, by extending the dynamic ray tracing equations. Don't need to really look at the equations. The idea is that we can solve various ODEs along the rays, and then we can calculate all these sensitivities, and then we can integrate all the sensitivities at the surface, because I said the Maslow approximation was an integral approximation, and then we can get an approximation to the Fréchet derivative. So this is what we're really interested in, the derivatives of travel times. We can calculate those from the ray tracing system. Derivative of slowness is, so P is essentially the gradient of travel time, so we can calculate those. And this is arrival position, we can calculate those as well, so it's possible. And we can put this all together and try and calculate the... So this is kind of ongoing work. So far it hasn't worked out terribly successfully, and it's not clear if there's real problems in the code or it's just some kind of numerical sensitivity, but we believe it should work because of our low frequency results that show us that the refracted energy is going to give us a pretty good inversion. We have to do quite a lot of regularization because the rays, of course, are one-dimensional objects. And the question is, they have to be regularized at least over a Fresnel zone to actually have any meaning. So I think it's more or less lunchtime, so I'll skip through this because I'm sure you're all hungry and your stomachs are rumbling. So what we really also would like to do is how do you know when you've inverted? Because you're solving a least squares objective function, you've got to have some kind of a measure of convergence on this residual error. And that's kind of a very subjective quantity. How do you measure error? So we're not going to answer the question how you measure error. What we're interested in is what happens if we change the objective function, what do our sensitivities look like, and what's our posterior covariance going to look like? So what about sensitivity? What about illuminated or unilluminated regions? So what we started to do is look at this as a fairly standard, I guess, resolution matrix analysis based on the fact that we're only going to compute matrix vector products. And because we're only going to compute matrix vector products, we can actually compute eigenvalues of the Hessian using an iterative eigenvalue solver. And that gives us a reasonable estimate of some of the uncertainty. So we can't compute Hessian. Hessian products we can compute quite easily. Let's ignore the equations. Hessian vector products, matrix vector products we like. We can't compute Jacobian, we can't compute Hessian. Products with a vector, we can do all those. So it turns out that when we actually look at the resolution of the inverse operator, there's only a few significant eigenvalues. So what we're actually seeing here is, I guess that's singular values rather, singular values, pretty high singular values there. Most of them decay to zero pretty rapidly. So most of them are insignificant. So again, this is work in progress to see, can we assess the uncertainty of the inversion operator? So what we can do is we can compute some of the eigenvectors. That's not very difficult. So what I've said today, if I can conclude, I gave an introduction to the kind of seismic problem. I tried to look at some PDE-constrained optimization that we're doing in Schlumberger, Cambridge, to solve for subsurface velocities. And then I mentioned that that's a real challenge in 3D, especially with the Helmholtz equation and with the multigrid solver. So then I said one way we're trying to avoid that is to avoid solving the two-way wave equation. The one approximation we've looked at so far is extensions to ray theory based on an integral ansatz. And then I started looking at what are we going to do with the inversion, because we really need to measure how good it is and what kind of uncertainties we have in our model. So I hope that gave you a flavour of some of the problems we're trying to tackle. So again, it's embarrassing that the waveform of the inversion still uses finite difference method, but it wouldn't make any difference if we did spectral element. It's still a volume discretization rather than a boundary discretization we're using here. And the multiscale approach, starting with low frequencies, moving on to high frequencies, seemed to work pretty well. And we wanted to look at some reduced physics, i.e. based on approximations which just give us refracted rays, turning rays, rather than reflected rays, for the imaging at low frequencies. And so this is an open question we're still trying to address. So what approximations for the wave equation can we get away with to actually give us a reasonable inversion for low frequencies? So I'll thank you for your time, and I'll stop there.